Cheers, everyone. And welcome to ULT in Philadelphia. And as our custom is to give you the decoration of Philadelphia ULT before we begin. And the purpose is to spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Hugh Judge. Therefore, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, or sex, or condition or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, it belongs to each and all. Now there are several other phrases on this wonderful pamphlet, and we advise you, if you have never been here before, to pick up one of these. It states within the program for October, November, and December. Now today being Sunday, December the 16th, what can life teach us about death? During the weekdays, for today we opened at 10:30, and you see we started promptly at 11. But during the weekdays, we open at 5:15, so you can come in and spend time in our library. The library closes at 7:15, and promptly at 7:30, we begin the study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. All you see participating, actually, are volunteers. And of course, on this little pamphlet, it'll tell you more about volunteering to help. That's most of the articles on here. You can concentrate on them by picking up one at the desk. It's our custom to give a short reading before we begin on Sundays. And the reading for today was taken from the Bhagavad Gita, page 11. And it's from that little book called the Bhagavad Gita, which you can inquire about at the book table. There are always volunteers around to guide you through the building. And in this article, Krishna himself is speaking. Don't know who Krishna is? Ask. Someone will be sure to point you to the library so that you can find out that wonderful little book, the Bhagavad Gita. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself never was not, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth. Nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. as the Lord of this mortal frame experiences their infancy, youth, and old age, so in future incarnation will it meet the same. One who's confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. The senses, moving toward their appropriate objects, are producers of heat and cold, pleasure and pain, which come and go and are brief and changeable. These do thou endure. O son of Bardhan, for the wise man whom these disturb not, and to whom pain and pleasure are the same, is fitted for immortality. There is no existence for that which does not exist, nor is there any non-existence for what exists. By those who see the truth and look into the principle of things, the ultimate characteristic of these both is seen. Learn that he by whom all things were formed is incorruptible, and that no one is able to effect the destruction of it, which is inexhaustible. These finite bodies which envelop the souls inhabiting them are said to belong to him, the eternal, the indestructible, unprovable spirit who is in the body. The man who believeth that it's this spirit which killeth, and he who thinketh that it may be destroyed, are both alike deceived. For it neither killeth nor is it killed. It is not a thing of which man may say, it hath been, is about to be, or is to be hereafter. For it is without birth and meeteth not death. It is ancient, constant, and eternal. And it's not slain when this its mortal frame is destroyed. How can the man who believeth that it is incorruptible, eternal, and inexhaustible, and without birth, think that it can either kill or cause to be killed? As a man throweth away old garments and putteth on new, even so the dweller in the body, having quitted its old mortal frames, entereth into others which are new. The weapon divideth it not. The fire burneth it not, the water corrupteth it not, the wind drieth it not away. For it is indivisible and inconsumable, incorruptible, and is not to be dried away. It is eternal, universal, permanent, immovable. It is invisible, inconceivable, and unalterable. Therefore, knowing it to be thus, thou shouldst not grieve. But whether thou believe it to be of eternal birth and duration, or that it dieth with the body, still thou hast no cause to lament it. Death is certain to all things which are born, and rebirth to all mortals. Wherefore it doth not behoove thee to grieve about the inevitable. The antenatal state of beings is unknown. The middle state is evident, and their state after death is not to be discovered. What in this is there to lament? Some regard the indwelling spirit as a wonder, while some speak and others hear of it with astonishment. But no one realizes it. Although he may have heard it described, this spirit can never be destroyed in the mortal frame which it inhabiteth. Hence, it is unworthy for thee to be troubled for all these mortals. We beg your attention.
Thank you. So, here we are in the month of December, considering the overall theme of cycles and cyclic law. And again, our topic this morning is, what can life, with a lowercase l, teach us about death? Death. From the viewpoint of popular culture, the man on the street, this may appear to be a pretty dismal concept for the festive December cycle of holidays and holy days. And more than a few in Western society would question even having this title scheduled at this time. Those who are atheists or scientific materialists, for them, death is the end, finite, boom, unknowable, that's the end of the story. For those who are out of the traditional Judeo-Christian sempiternity tradition, there is a dilemma, because frequently when death is experienced, there's an inconsolable reaction, especially when there are sudden deaths among loved ones or deaths among the very young. And then the process of why and the sense of victimization is very apparent in their thinking. There are those who, despite decades having passed, come into the December cycle of holidays and holy days grieving for those who are missing at the family tables, even decades later. And even for those who hold with the notion, the concept of reincarnation, the deep cycles of grief can be experienced very vividly, even while that soul is striving to transmute the sensation into something higher, to put it in its place, and to strive to remain centered, if not detached, enough to observe, enough to learn, enough to assimilate. So for all these thinkers in the popular culture, one thing is true, as these words that you heard from Krishna from over 5,000 years ago, at the moment of birth into physical body, biorhythms, cycles commence, and these cycles, akin to the Hindu notions of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, date the form. There's a duration for the form. The form will die or dissipate upon physical death. For seekers of the truth, and they may be in any one of those categories mentioned in the popular culture, for those, there is a reasoned effort, a reasoned faith to consider and to make meaning of alleged or perceived tragedies and death, to learn and to assimilate from life in the body as better able to be able to help and teach others. And so we come again to the question for this morning's consideration for all those who are moving through the human condition. What can life teach us about death? The true meaning of religion is a preparation for and a knowledge of life, with all caps, and ever living. If we use our time while we're alive, working through the physical frame, to look at great nature, what's called the macrocosm, we see the interdependence of the web of life, we can ponder the cycles that we experience, and we begin to assimilate, we begin to confirm that inner impressed notion that in fact, nothing in great nature happens only once. The youngest of children among us can look around the city streets and parks today and realize that although the deciduous trees appear dead right now, they're brimming with life. There's an internal expedition, if you will, preparing it for the next cycle of growth. For those who are a little bit older and very aware of the cycle of seasons and appreciate the cycle of the seasons, the angle of the sun that changes with each passing day, the interplay between the winter months and the spring time when plants can be planted and come to fruition again, that annual cycle of apparent death followed by life renewed is very informative and very much consoling and reaffirming of that sense of endlessness that each of us shares. We can look at the moon cycle and the tides. Always and everywhere, cyclic law pervades. And since that's the case, and since we are mind beings, regardless of where we are in the popular culture, we can look at the inner nature of the microcosm, man and the other sentient beings, and again, look at the interdependence of life and life cycles. We can ponder what we experience. We can assimilate again in our own minds and experiences that nothing happens only once. If we look at a daily life experience for each and for all, we see the cycle of waking and sleeping, but we know the continuity of self, I am, through all states of consciousness. Those of us who are a tad bit more mellowed out, like fine wine, shall we say, a tad bit more aged, know that we have as soul used a whole series of physical bodies, most of which are dead and gone, in a 7-year cycle of a sloughing off of the lower forms. Although those forms from infancy, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, those forms are gone, we still recognize ourselves in the mirror. Not because of the form that's looking back at us. That's transient, passing. What we recognize is that impressed inner nature, that sense of I am. And so for any seeker of truth, for any student of life, any scientist of life, if you will, using basic principles, using analogies, correspondences, life has a lot to offer us to understand the life and death cycle and to prepare to participate in that cycle as fully as we can. Life can teach us that spirit overrides and directs, it involves in matter, and spirit is oneness. That in that sense of beingness that we share, in that power to perceive and make meaning, we find the true nature of soul, the true nature of what it is using the human state. Through all states of consciousness, through dream state in the dead of night, through daydreams, through meditation and prayer periods, through study times when we're trying to read, through all those states of consciousness, through all changes of moods, however they may be, in any stage of grief, in any stage of ecstasy, everything in between, there has to be something permanent that can perceive those states, measure that state, observe that state, and yet not be submerged or lost in it. So life teaches us that whether there's an active physical body or not, that sense of continuity, that oneness of spirit or soul, is transcendent. Then life has a different thing for human beings who are self-conscious and self-fulfilled. The sense of I can, I will, and I must is impressed within. And what else is that but a sense of evolution, that there is a growth compelling us, that there's a seeking from within, an intuitive sense of progress, of growing, of gaining more experience, of learning how to use that experience on behalf of others. And that process is also an invitation to purify our minds, our hearts, our motives, so that we have no fear in whatever aspect of the cycle of life and death that we're using. It is said that all action springs from and is colored by the motives held while we perform the actions. So if we can learn in life to hold a one-pointed, centered, detached stance of mind and heart, if we can learn to concentrate, to be observant, to be meditative, moment by moment, regardless of what the experiences are, we begin to learn to dwell in the eternal, the bliss of the moment. And we make in that practice the effort to grow, the effort to perfect. Perfectibility is relative at best. But we make the effort as seers, as perceivers, to make real, to realize principles and ideals. And in that process, if we're to think about the analogy of a day in the life, how is any one day of life like an incarnation? Well, it is said that by the ancients that upon coming into a physical form, the soul is and has a clear moment of seeing. I exist. I'm in harmony with the One. I have a clear moment of a sense, the aroma or the aspect of what this life is going to be like. We think about our daily life, we know that that occurs as we begin to awaken each morning. We have a sense of existence, a sense of gradual perception of the world, and then an engagement in a particular physical day. We know within the day of any time, we have ebb and flow of cycles, don't we? There's some periods of time during a day when we're very active mentally, other times when we need periods of rest or rejuvenation. And so we again begin to see periods of activity and rest, almost as a natural pulse in the skandhas or the gunas, the conditions with which we're working. So too, in the after-death states, there is a time for activity and rest. It's not objective, it's certainly not at this plane, but subjectively, there's a period for assimilation of the highest ideals and periods of rest or dissipation when energy that's been imbued in the astral and the inner man is dissipated before the next life. Many who were students of the philosophy set aside time at the end of a day to think back about the day that was lived. What were my ideals and goals in the morning? How did I experience life and conditions during the course of the day? Was I able to stay centered and balanced? Did I lose my grip here and there emotionally? How'd I do? And what questions may I want answered in deep sleep? What is it that's undone that needs yet to be done? That final review that we consciously and willfully practice in the evening is very similar to what is going to happen in those final hours when spirit, soul, the metaphysical levels of life begin to pull away from the physical body and the desire body. Again, a final review of an entire life is very similar to a daily final review of a 24-hour time period. So what can life teach us? How can we prepare now for a, quote, good death, a fruitful assimilation of the highest ideals we can imagine, so that in another day, another life, we can serve great nature and we can serve all of humanity better than we have before? Well, day by day, we can hold in our minds the consideration that the ego, the eternal true soul, is to an incarnation of one life as a personality, that which we see in through our lower minds, is to one day. We can see that the Christian notion of daily bread, give us this day our daily bread, that comes to us 24/7 on every single plane and level of life. If only we remain open and conscious and observant, whenever we need in terms of soul nutrition, in terms of physical comfort, that will come to us as the universe speaks. It's there. It may be a passing comment from someone on the street. It may be something that we hear in a radio or a TV show. We may accidentally pick up a magazine in a waiting room somewhere and see an article that has just the nugget that we've been hoping to consider and use to solve life's problems. We can make note of all of life's events and cycles as best we can. Some journal, some use just consideration. But if we observe and make notes of the behavior of our beloved, of strangers, if we're considering, gee, where's the oneness? What do I appreciate by what I'm seeing? Or where is my compassion for what I'm experiencing? We have a lot that we can learn to build those ideals that will stay with the soul for life to come. We work calmly within the conditions available as best we can, and we use all that is available to us to make real, to realize spiritual life while in the body. So whether it's whispered hints from the universe, whether it's a dear friend speaking loudly mouth to ear, we have plenty to ponder, to consider, to actively meditate on as soul moving through the human condition. Even making records of dreams, making records of cycles of emotions, going back to the concept of biorhythms, trying to see where's the tide of life and how can I best use it? When do I have to learn to surf and go with the flow? And when is it that the tides are best for me to use mind, soul, and body to bloom, to be all that we can be? And ultimately, in that process of testing and exploring what daily life has to offer, we hope to build intuition. So at some point in time, that soul wisdom that we've accumulated can bubble through and we can use it automatically in all occurrences, if you will. The spiritual ego, the true soul that is the human, moves like a pendulum in the duration of eternity. It collects nectar or the aroma of moral consciousness and the qualities of ideals. And then we continue to live, to create, to recreate, to make real, to perfect the powers of mind, knowing that life has taught us that life is despite the death of form. Look at the deciduous trees. and know that there is one life, that the day is used to purify and transmute even when there's a period of rest or death, and therefore we can live fearlessly and without grief, as Krishna advised over 5,000 years ago, to live harmoniously with the one life and all, and to live for the all. Now, I'll bet you, with this title, that you came this morning with your own thoughts on the subject matter, because it was a very interesting title. Yes, sir?
Common experience, we think, is that what we do go through is the effect of causes we set up by our thinking and feeling. And even if 10 people go through the same physical experience, the way they subjectively experience it as an effect depends on their thought and feeling.
Mm-hmm.
What does that teach us about the after-death state in relationship to the causes we set up by our thought and feeling in this life?
Well, scientists today would tell us that they really still know very little about how the physical brain that we use works. But we do know more than we did a couple hundred years ago. We know about electromagnetics. There was a text called The Body Electric that was published a couple decades ago. So we are more aware now that as thinkers, we generate ideas, we radiate those ideas, and depending on the motives that we hold, whether high or low, depending on the force, the energy, the imagination and will that we bring to those ideas have an afterlife of their own. They have a duration of their own. We know when the pendulum swings, depending on the force of the pendulum, that motion is going to continue until finally the energy is dissipated. So as we move through life and we hold certain ideas, a lifetime meditation, whatever it may be, and we invest thought and feeling and volition and will and energy in whatever that idea is, as we consistently do that, we've set up a fund or a bank of energy that needs to be dissipated. At the lower levels in the after-death states, some traditional churches used to talk about purgatory or limbo. I believe that some of those concepts are now adjusted or edited. But there was the notion that in the after-death states, that those lower dregs, the lower aspects of selfish desires and lifetime meditations are dissipated, and that in a heaven state, the highest aspirations, the thoughts and echoes of those thoughts that are generated in daily life are then assimilated in the highest heavenly or devachanic state that we can imagine. Did you have more thoughts on that, anybody? No? Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned limbo. It's funny because we do believe that they don't.
I think it's been dropped.
It's been dropped.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that from what we understand, the original concept was for the innocents,
yes,
and the unbaptized, that they can't really, they shouldn't suffer, so there should be a state which they...
A neutral state.
A neutral state. But the philosophy says that those very young souls that are taken out actually come back very quickly, sometimes even in the same, often from what we understand, in the same family.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's been studies done that they have a lot of the same traits as the young child that was taken from the family, which in itself, of course, is a lesson.
Yeah. And probably one of the lessons to that is that as part of the process of reading about the different world religions and considering them equally and respectfully, we can line them up and find the commonalities and therefore begin to trace the original ancient wisdom, divine essence that stands behind all the religions. So that notion of karma-less, you know, the very, very young who pass away without having created positive or negative karma, under 7 years old, there's nothing really much to dissipate or assimilate, is there? And therefore, the soul might be drawn right back into life more readily than another who has invested a tremendous amount of time in a very a lower plane existence, or another who spends many hours imagining an utopia and how to achieve that, however they're defining it. There would be more to dissipate. Yeah.
Well, in listening to the language that we hear in these rooms, we have to stop and think. And in order to think, we have to hear how we should approach these teachings. And such phrases as the knowledge of existing things, the non-existent, and in the reading this morning, there is no existent for that which does not exist, nor is there any non-existent for what exists, are quite puzzling. So there must be a fundamental idea which will help us to thread our way through the language that we hear. Learn that he by whom all things were formed is incorruptible. These finite bodies which envelop the souls inhabiting them are said to belong to him, the eternal, the indestructible, unprovable spirit who is in the body. That's a lot of words. Could you reassess those words?
Oh, in 24 words or less, sure. Well, you know, that's Krishna speaking in a beautifully poetic form. And probably from the Western Judeo-Christian traditions, where people are used to hearing the Lord's Prayer being spoke. That first line, "Our Father who art in heaven," that says it all. There is one universal source or fount in a metaphysical or heaven state, an abstract state. The philosophy calls it the absolute, that has absolutely no attributes, but radiates, emanates within itself all manifestation and all attributes. And that oneness that we can only begin to imagine through analogy and correspondence, really, because we're working through finite matter. That oneness, our Father, our source in a heaven state, in the most abstract, all-encompassing, absolute state we can envision, that is the one source of all. That is eternal. And whether there is manifestation emanating within and without that, through it, in it, whatever language we're struggling with, or whether there's a pralaya, there's a time period when all manifestation has retreated into the oneness and again is without attribute, the reality is that it is. I am that I am. I am that. Yeah.
One of the things that we notice about our waking life, and is referred to by the chair, there can be many distractions.
Oh, yeah.
We're constantly aware of opposites in people and conditions, and our minds are constantly wandering. And yet, there are those times when we're so absorbed state. Maybe it's, if it's not a meditative, it's an artistic, a creative state. So absorbed in it that everything else is like it's not there. There is no awareness of any contrast. What does that teach us about the nature of our consciousness in that, in those after-death states, as compared to this waking state of consciousness?
The waking state of consciousness, the mundane, if you will, where our mind is engaged with some perceived objective reality, and perhaps we allow the monkey mind, that stream of consciousness, to take over, where there's this passive, just daydreaming, floating from one idea to the other, kind of a diverse, multi-purposed, multitasked thinking. That kind of frittered away energy and lack of one-pointedness can lead to a habit, a character, an entire, if you will, destiny of incarnation, where there has to be effort made once again to become introspective, to be on top of metacognition, to begin to focus one-pointedness. And that is kind of a passive, mindless existence. There is a different kind of mindlessness, as was alluded to. If you talk to a poet, if you are acquainted with a painter or a sculptor or a writer, a child with a Lego kit, someone that has a hobby, knitting, crocheting, whatever the creative essence is, that one-pointed focus, there's a mindless level. In other words, there's no awareness of sensation or the outside objective world, but rather there's been a shift of consciousness so that that one-pointedness is all there is, that creative, in the moment, now. Sometimes somebody that is an avid reader will get caught up in a book. Next thing you know, they realize 4 hours have gone past. They need a potty break, but they're too stiff to get there. Why? Because they've been disengaged from the external planes. We can take that example and use it for meditative purposes. If there's a little book called Pantagali's Yoga Aphorisms on how to quiet the external mind, the monkey mind, and put away the senses of the external world and turn that one-pointedness inward so that soul can speak, so that we might be able to recall the dreams from deep sleep. Not a trance state, but a very active meditation state. If we pursue that, then we can only imagine that in the after-death states, as soul leaves the body disintegrates and becomes very alive on this plane with bacteria and everything else, with all the metamorphosis that goes on physically. As soul moves through the after-death states, Kamaloka would be like that frittering away, that mindlessness, you know, the monkey mind, lower passions and desires, sensory experiences, and the devaconic heavenly state, that assimilative state, a subjective state, would be more akin to the meditative state that was practiced in waking hours. Yes?
So, with our incarnations, you were talking about there was, I guess it's in the soul, an aspect of the soul to always want to become more perfect or better. And I guess my question is, do we believe that, that's already there, or could we go from one life to another life and just have to like fight through it again to get to that level, or do we build on that? In other words, is this striving to be better? Because I'm not so sure everybody is striving to be better. So is that something that we have to like recreate, or are we building on it?
Well, if we think about very young children, born equally with potential, despite whatever conditions they're going to go home to from the hospital. If we watch toddlers, there seems to be an impressed sense of me, of I can do this, me self. They're very clear on that. They're very clear with a sense of justice. That's not fair. And also, if you watch them, they don't see, they enjoy the array of beauty of human nature, male, female, black, white, blue, green, they just get along together. So it would seem that even at a stage of life where soul is, but yet isn't really fully self-conscious and self-propelling, we see certain intuitive, instinctual impress of what it is to be human across lives and across incarnations. As adults, once it's said after the age of conscience, after 7 years old, as a soul begins to use a more and more sophisticated instrument and is conditioned by external thought and tendencies, someone could, a soul could, by a willful sense of use of life, begin to extinguish those impulses. They're there, but they may be suppressed, and so we might see a narcissist in full bloom. If everything is karmic, you know, whatever causes we set up, we are definitely going to see the effects. We might be able to mitigate them. In between times, we may be able to learn a little bit on how to respond and to use the effects to a better avail. Life's an experiment. So that no effort would be lost. And it would take eons of time for a soul to be so lost that they've so extinguished that internal intuitive nature that the soul would just dissipate. That would be very rare. Yeah.
And we're talking about the living and the dead, life and death. We recall back then during the war, if you were in the camp, standing in line, the chief petty officer would say, "Now hear this." Well, 90% of us heard the words. But when we are being punished for not paying attention, didn't you hear what I said? Pay attention next time. So what we learn in these rooms is to pay attention to what you hear. And apply. So in order to pay attention, we have to look within ourselves. So that's why we have to spend time considering these words privately, etc. And many of us say, "Aha, now I see what he means." Well, we come again and again to listen, but we have to pay attention. And meditation, and that's when we discover there's something within us that is much, much more direct than what we personally consider to be the truth. That's why we listen.
Listening is really, really important, because if we don't listen to that old adage, count to 10 before we speak, or it's Rumi, I believe, the poet Rumi, who said, speak only what is necessary, speak what is true, and speak what is kind. Well, if we try to practice that, and we're not flapping our jaws, the ears will open. We will be more available to hear the universe speaking, to see what's going on, to remain as mindful as we can. That's not to say that any one of us at any one period of time, 10 times out of 10, is going to be able to move through the course of a day and hit the mark every single time and be open to hearing the voice of the universe, to having the patience to listen to the other and to try to puzzle, where the Harrys are they coming from? What do I understand about that activity? But we try our best. We have an ideal that we're investing in way behind.
Could we speak upon the idea of the observer within us?
The observer within us?
Yes.
The philosophy teaches a duality of mind, if you will, that emanating from this spiritual font of oneness is spiritual soul, a permanent entity that is like the sutratma, the silver thread upon which all the incarnations are arrayed like beads. And then there is a human soul, lower mind, working with the daily wants and needs of physical life, and that how we identify. You tell a child, it's been done in an educational experiment, I'm ashamed to admit, you tell a whole class and a teacher, boy, this is a group of mutts, they can't learn anything. They're very limited kids. You're going to have a rough year with them. Good luck. You tell the teacher in the room next door with an almost identical group of kids, this is the brightest group you are ever going to meet in your career. You're going to have a fantastic year. They're going to surpass all benchmarks. It's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we are not observant, if we don't take the stand of the spiritual self, the eternal observer, the perceiver, the power to know, the power to see, the power to create meaning, the thinker, the eternal, if we're not that ruler with which we can measure life's events and our lower reactions, then what do we become? We're the rubber ruler, the stretchy elastic of that lower personal soul, where we just respond in different ways at different times. And we can become enmeshed if we identify with that lower sense of mind. And that's it. Then you have produced the popular thoughts of there's only one life, and then there's eternal heaven, or there's only this life, it was an accident, it's a random ball game, and when it's over, it's over. Or we can try to take the stand of that observer and see what happens, test it out. Nothing spoken in these rooms is offered as a dogma or a creed. Instead, what's offered in these rooms is the ability to come together as a group of thinkers, to compare world religions, to compare philosophies, to try to see where science may connect with religion and philosophy, come together to try to reason out what's the true nature of soul moving through the human state. What are the ethics with which we live? What can life teach us? What can we offer each other in the way of help? but there's nothing to be believed or accepted, or that would be a line of malarkey. Yeah.
Well, one thing we've learned is that our perception of time is very relative to our attitude, to our motives, our thoughts and feelings, our state of consciousness, basically. What does that teach us about time in those after-death states?
Oh, well, let's think about time right now. I started speaking this sentence in the past. I'm still running my mouth, and I'm going to finish the sentence in the future. So where's time? It's a duration. It's a moment. And where we can measure life on this planet by the cycles of the sun, and we try to measure what a year is, and don't even start with leap years. It just gets very complicated. Trying to make finite something, we're trying to nail jello on the wall. There is an eternal moment. There's a duration of energy, if you will, and then a period, a duration of a retreat into the absolute. We know from our dream states, daydreams or deep sleep, that an entire novel can be experienced, I mean, decades, in less than a couple seconds. The power of the human soul moving with mind through a physical brain is really remarkable. So too, in the after-death states, things are all subjective. There is no causation being set up in Kamaloka, or the after-death state of the sloughing off. It's an effect state. It's just a dissipation of a state. There's no true soul there directing anything. The duration, again, would be the force given to those experiences while the perceiver was in the physical body in a conscious life. The Devakani, that process of assimilation of the highest aspirations and ideals, again, that would evolve, that would be a duration depending on the force given to those aspirations. But it is said that we can learn a lot by life if we look at history. If you look at about a 1,500-year cycle, one of the most fun experiments for a history teacher is to look at ancient Rome and look at the United States of America. The parallels in art, architecture, science, technology, the development of an empire, the role of immigrants into the society, the parallels go on and on and on. Spectator sports, don't even get me started about stadiums and arenas. The parallels are remarkable. And most of the ancient sources would point that on average, there's about a 1,500-year gap between one incarnation and another. And you can test that out for yourself. You don't just use the Romans. You can look at any other numbers of civilizations and say, wow, there seems to be a commonality of the souls coming in a particular time period. Did you have a different thing that you were considering?
Well, that's very true. If we were to measure it off by years,
yeah,
it would be maybe 1,000 to 1,500 years by the sun and so forth. But does it seem like that long to the soul in that state?
It depends on your attitude, doesn't it? Haven't we sat through lectures or classes where, oh my word, the time, it's got to be 5 hours long and there's still 20 minutes left in a 45-minute period. There are other episodes that we may have. There might be a different class, different day, different subject, where it seems like the whole experience was over in a flash of the eye. Everything is subjective. And we are literally out of time. But Wednesday night, 5:15, the building will open. The reference library will be available. There'll be volunteers available to help you out with anything you'd like to look at. And there's a whole series of articles from a little book called The Ocean of Theosophy, which will answer a whole bunch of questions. Have a great day and a good week.